Their father was tall?
She was 6 feet tall, Agent Pine told me. She did some work as a model, in fact. Buckley nodded.
And both daughters are tall, strong, fierce even, with exemplary fighting skills. I saw Mercy Pine's handiwork. I assume her sister is equally talented. I saw the Wikipedia page. She almost made the Women's Olympic weightlifting team. Impressive.
Both sisters have had to overcome a great deal of adversity.
Good, good. However, I doubt that your Agent Pine has ever been physically tortured, as her sister has.
No, I don't believe so. But why in the world does that matter to you?
Being able to endure pain is a source of great strength, I believe. It gives one an edge over another, perhaps the critical edge.
I suppose so, but again, I don't see the relevancy.
But you don't have to, Ms. Blum, because I do.
I'm not getting out of here alive, am I?
No, you're not. And neither are the Pine sisters.
Blum now looked alarmed. They're not here, are they? He rose and tapped the bars with his finger, gracing her with an eager look.
Not yet.
Chapter 62. Brit Spector had to admit the scheme was brilliant and risky. That didn't lessen the brilliance. It just made the plan more complicated and special. Her admiration for Buckley had been displaced by a growing concern for the man. He was taking all of this far too personally. She understood that it was his brother, but it seemed to have evolved into a personal grudge that was now devolving into a terrible, looming confrontation, and she was uncertain of the exact shape it would take. She had walked the grounds of the compound. Knowing the geography of a place was critical, if you wanted to make it out the other end. She had great faith in Peter Buckley, but when things went sideways with something like this, they often went terribly wrong. And then faith was just a word, a useless one. Then you were on your own. This was her first time here. The place was rugged, imposing. If you didn't know what you were doing, survival out here would not be easy. He had never spoken of the place. She knew some of Buckley's background, and she had researched the history of this place once she learned where they were heading. His childhood had been as unusual and potentially as damaging as her own, so how could she judge the man harshly? She stared out at the distant mountain range and the less distant foothills. Canyons had been carved in the earth here by once mighty rivers that had vanished over time. She had driven all over this land after they'd arrived, getting a feel for it, trying to understand its secrets. Because one just never knew, did one? She headed to the new two-story building, where Buckley had told her the old hay barn had once stood. A team was already there setting up the structure inside it. The steel posts had been sunk into the dirt and reinforced with concrete footers. The chain-link perimeter fence was being strung along these posts. It rose 10 feet. She patted one of the posts. It didn't give an inch. Cement shoes on a dead man. Buckley had thought of it all. Spector went over the plans with the crew chief. He had been well paid, had no idea what this ultimately would be used for, and didn't want to know. As soon as they were finished, he and his men would be on a chartered plane out of here and back to the country from where Buckley had recruited them. This tale, for them, would end with the wheels up and the beer flowing. She left the barn and kept walking, turning left and heading down the main street of the place. It really was a wonder that so many people had lived here at one point, and died here. The graveyard held well over 100 plots, simply inscribed with just first names on now rotted wooden markers. Buckley had told her that these folks had all died of natural causes. She didn't believe that, and wasn't sure he did either. She wasn't certain how he reconciled that in his own mind. Maybe he never had. Spector looked up. This was a part of the country where the sky seemed to go on forever. There wasn't another living soul within at least 100 miles. When they had been coming in on the jet, she had looked out the window. She saw flat, rugged land frequently interrupted by buttes, rocky outcrops, a line of foothills, and finally, their bigger, blunt-faced mountain cousins in the distance with snowy caps. She saw birds and animals and patches of water and some vegetation among the mostly stripped red earth, but not a single human being. She had come to realize that Buckley much preferred that arrangement. He had told her that he would come here for days at a time and just wander. He said that the power of the isolation astonished him.
We're all hamsters on the wheel, Britt. We never stop long enough to try to understand what we really want, what we're really doing. It's all a mirage based on speed and lack of personal focus and thought.
If you say so, Peter, she had replied at the time, clearly not pleasing him, which had been her intent. She was not simply going to agree. That made her trivial and, worst of all, fungible. To matter to the man, you had to be unique. And one way to do that was not to blithely follow his lead. Spectre wondered if Buckley had thought of that during some of his wanderings here. It was the simplicity of his plan that appealed to her. Yet for her, a bullet, a garrote, a blow to the base of the skull, a knife, or even a delicious little poison surreptitiously delivered would have served just as well. In the face of that, Buckley might say that she had no style, no burst of imagination. She would have agreed. Spectre wasn't seeking masterpieces. She was no Da Vinci. She was more workmanlike. She believed herself more akin to Michelangelo, indisputably a genius. But there was a lunch pail and overalls practicality to his mastery that, in her mind, eclipsed even the dreamy, luminary vision of the Mona Lisa's creator. She had made additional discreet inquiries with the Bureau that had yielded a substantial treasure of potentially helpful intelligence. Some of those she had disclosed to Buckley, and some she had not. She walked into the little jail, passed the guard, entered the cell area, and stared through the bars at Carol Blum. She had been the one to abduct the woman back in Asheville, pointing a gun at her through the Porsche's window. Blum had been astute enough to know that the look on Spectre's face brooked no opposition and no hesitancy to shoot her in the head, so she had surrendered. Spectre had heard the woman mutter something like, "Not again." This struck her as odd, but she had to admire Blum's nerves. She was not one to be intimidated. She had to know her fate was sealed, but she didn't act like it. That in itself was impressive. Blum looked at her through the bars. "You look familiar somehow, and I don't mean from Asheville." "I doubt it." "Can you tell me your name?" "Not prudent on my part. Mr. Buckley had no problem telling me his, or the history of this place and his family's connection. That's his choice. I work differently." "Meaning you're not overconfident. I find men so often are, even the smart ones, particularly when it comes to women." "I can't disagree with that. In fact, I agree with it." "I assume he pays you well." Spectre put one hand on the bars. "Sometimes it doesn't seem enough. Like right now. Pangs of conscience. What can you tell me about Mercy Pine?" "Mr. Buckley already asked. I only just met her. I can't say I know her."
"But you spent some time with her. I see you as a quick study. If you're admin at the Bureau, you would have to be."
"Do you know the Bureau?" Blum said quickly.
Spectre smiled.
"Anyone who does what I do has to pay attention to the FBI. Read into that what you will."
"What do you want to know?"
"I understand she had a rough upbringing under Desiree Atkins."
"That's one word for it, and probably not the right one."
"But she got away and built a life?"
"She did. And she allegedly killed Buckley's brother, so in his warped mind, her life has to end as recompense of some kind."
"Did Agent Pine meet her sister?"
"She hasn't, as far as I know. I'm not sure what Mercy did when she found out I was gone."
"Yes. We thought you two were together. She was watching the house?"
"I'm not quite sure why you didn't try to take her then."
"You weren't the only one wondering that. But I follow orders, I don't give them."
"Why do you want to know about her?"
Spectre rubbed the single scar on her arm, the remaining souvenir of her own personal hell of a childhood.
It's interesting to me how people facing similar challenges in life turn out very differently by making very different choices.
That speaks surely to the individuality of the person in question, replied Blum, looking intently at Spectre. Did you suffer something similar to Mercy Pine, which led to different choices for you?
Spectre looked uncomfortable with the bluntness of the query. I believe I thought I had made the right choices. I guess you would call it being on the side of right, as silly as that sounds.
It doesn't sound silly at all to me. What happened?
Meaning?
Meaning you clearly are not on the side of right any longer.
To use your own words, surely that speaks to the individuality of the person in question.
Blum cocked her head and looked disappointed. You know as well as I do that there are limits to how far that argument can be expanded and employed.
Perhaps I do.
And just so there's no misassumption on your part, I understand that you're having this somewhat frank discussion with me because I will shortly not be alive to recount it to anyone else.
But I didn't reveal my name. Does that give you some hope?
Not enough, Blum replied bluntly.
She was silent for a bit, and then said wistfully,
When I joined the Bureau decades ago, I had a family to raise. There was no question of my becoming a special agent. I don't even remember who or when the first female agent was.
Spectre said promptly, Alaska Packard Davidson back in 1922. Her brother started the Packard Car Company. She was 54 when she became a special investigator for the Bureau of Investigation, the FBI's predecessor.
Blum took up the story. That's right. I remember that now. But then Hoover became director and got rid of the female agents.
But in 1972, Hoover died, and the Bureau graduated the first two female special agents since 1929.
Susan Rowley, said Blum. I don't know the other.
Joanne Pierce, replied Spectre. Blum gave her an appraising look that simulated the point of a sharp knife, prompting a smiling Spectre to say, That was neatly done, as it now appears clear that you knew all of the Bureau history answers.
But that's beside the point. And with what I now know about you, I am truly saddened.
Spectre's smile faded. I don't recall saying that your opinion of me was important.
But it saddens me still, and that's my prerogative.
Everyone makes choices, men and women.
And you've clearly already made yours. I'm just collateral damage. Some would say I've lived long enough. My children are grown, I'm not married. In the end, who would miss me for very long? I'll soon be a faded picture on the wall.
The blunt response hardened Spectre's look, but a glimmer of a softer underbelly lingered in her eyes. You don't strike me as a person who wallows in self-pity.
If I wallow in anything, it's in reality, replied Blum sharply.
I hope Pine appreciates you as her admin, said Spectre.
She will remember me fondly, I hope, if she has the chance to.
Spectre put her face an inch from the bars. She was clearly done scratching around the edges of this back-and-forth conversation. Look, you seem like a nice lady. I have no doubt you're a dedicated public servant. The same with your boss. I have no grudge against Mercy Pine either. She's obviously had a shitty life. I have no personal beef with any of you.
But it's the old story, right? You have a job to do.
There is a lot at stake.
There always is when you're going to take someone's life. Or at least there should be. It's supposed to be what separates us from all other animals.
Blum seemed to stare right through the woman.
But you already know that. And it's not just about choices, is it? Even for former FBI special agents.
On that, Spectre pursed her lips, turned and walked out. Blum could have felt triumphant with this parting shot, yet all she felt was sadness for a life wasted, and more loss yet to come. Chapter 63. Mercy sat in her aged Civic, gazing out the window, but not really seeing much.
She had many things she could have been thinking about after walking out on her sister. What her mind was riveted on for some reason was that Sally was in her duffel in the Porsche, and she might never see the doll again. Part of Mercy knew this was trivial, bordering on the ridiculous, but she just could not let it go. She ran her hand over the grimy steering wheel and thought about someone else holding Sally right now, and that thought made her mad. Only it was not really about the doll, she knew. She had just done a full-blown psycho session on her twin. Those things needed to be said, because Mercy had felt all of them. To keep it all bottled up inside was to invite an explosion of an even more epic nature later. Better to let the pressure valve do its thing. Her sister didn't deserve to be on the receiving end of Mercy's emotional salvo, but she was the only one handy, and thus she had gotten both barrels. Yet she also knew things could not be left here. But it was complicated, and that was the reason for the focus on Sally. Dolls were simple. You held them and pretended they were alive, and that they loved you unconditionally. It required nothing more than a modicum of imagination to carry it all off. But then real life intruded and cut you off at the knees. Real life needed to be confronted and dealt with, mistakes and all. She needed 3 more minutes of Sally time, where in her mind palace she was a little girl again, and the only worries she carried were what imaginary tea to use for her imaginary tea party with her imaginary friends, and whether her rambunctious sister would be able to work her way down from a tall tree and set foot back on the earth alive and well. Mercy took the luxury of the full 3 minutes, and then Sally and Simple were gone. She got out of the car and leaned against the roof, having to bend over slightly because of her height. It was a pretty day, a cloudless sky. She had things to be happy about. Desiree was in prison. She had found her twin. She now knew something of her real father. And that the man who had helped raise her might still be alive and living with her mother, the tall lady with the piled-up hair and infectious smile, an image that had just returned to her after all those years. She could drive back home and resume her life with those accomplishments in her back pocket, even without Sally by her side. She could do this, because for most of her life it had just been her. She'd had no one else that she cared about, because no one she knew cared about her. When you got into that groove, an important set of basic human emotional instincts, like love and devotion, were eroded, like muscles atrophied from disuse. And her Good Samaritan routine now began to make more sense to her. I give money to people I don't know. I help them because I know what it's like to not have anything. But that's easy. I slip them a few bucks and walk away. There's no other obligation, no lasting responsibility. I don't have to do anything hard. If they live or die, get hurt or sick, it doesn't affect me. It doesn't touch me because I have no real link to any of them. But with people who cared about you, who loved you, it was different. That road ran both ways, and so did the responsibility. And that suddenly scared her more than anything she'd ever fought in her life. A direct connection to someone else who really matters, who really counts, so that if I lost it, I would feel the pain. And it would hurt far more than even what Desiree had done to me. Yes, so much easier. And also painless to walk away. Instead, she trudged back into the hotel and took the stairs up. She walked down the hall and rapped on the door. Pine answered, the fresh tears still sticking to her face like hot wax on a death mask. She seemed far more surprised to see Mercy standing there than Mercy felt standing there. Did I always know I was coming back? Probably. Pine closed the door behind her sister, and she sat on the bed while Mercy stood. How do we find Carol? Mercy asked simply. Pine wiped at her face, cleared her throat, and went into FBI mode. We have APBs out on her and the car. The Porsche will have been abandoned. She may already be out of the state by now. And as time goes by, maybe out of the country. I don't think so. What? The dude wants me, like you said. Him just having Carol ain't gonna cut it. She's a means to an end. Pine pushed her hair out of her face. You're right, she is. so he's going to use Carol to get to me. At least he's going to try.
Mercy nodded, chewing on this line for a bit.
Since he's using her as leverage, we can use me as bait. That's how we get to Carol.
No, that's how you get dead, Mercy.
Well, Carol can end up dead, too.
I know that, which is why we have to handle this really carefully.
They're going to contact you somehow. They're going to want you to give me over for Carol,
which I can't and won't do.
But if I'm cool with it, you don't have a choice.
That is not how this works, said Pine firmly.
Why not? It's free country.
I can't let you just give yourself up to be killed.
So you'd sacrifice your friend for me?
Asked Mercy. This blunt statement hit Pine like the punch delivered by Spectre had her gut. Her face flamed, her lips set in a straight, unflinching line, and her hands curled to fists. She looked to Mercy like the little dungaree-clad girl about to assault another tree and win. Pine said,
I'm not sacrificing anybody. My goal is to get Carol back safe and sound without losing you in the process.
Mercy sat down in the chair.
And how will you do that?
I'm working on it.
No, you're still recovering from the mental avalanche I dropped on your head just now.
A few moments of profound silence passed between the women. In a cracking voice, Pine said,
You obviously felt the need to say it all, and you also came back. Why?
The fists had now uncurled to shaky fingers, Mercy noted. The little girl was solidly on Earth, but perhaps more afraid than if she'd been up an 80-foot poplar with no way down and a lightning storm coming. Mercy shrugged in the face of this question, partly because it was complex, and partly because she didn't really have an answer that she believed would satisfy her twin.
You worked hard to try to find me. Seems shitty to walk out on you when you need some help. And Carol doesn't deserve to get killed over this. It's not her problem. It's mine.
This blunt and honest assessment seemed to wick the tension from Pine's body. She relaxed and looked down. Carol is really the only good friend I have. I depend on her for everything. She's taught me a lot.
This dude who took her. Anything else you can remember about what he said?
Why?
He said I killed his brother. Something you remember him saying might give me a clue as to what the hell he's talking about and who the hell his brother was.
But you said you didn't kill anybody.
I haven't, but he sure seems to think I have.
Pine said, I can't think of anything, and I never saw his face. I got hit twice, but I don't think by him. Whoever did it knew what they were doing.
Mercy said, only your face? You look tight in the torso, too.
Pine lifted up her shirt to reveal a mass of yellow and black bruising on the left side of her abdominal wall, bleeding over to her oblique like a stain.
Fist? Or some kind of weapon? Asked Mercy, clinically observing the marks.
Fist. I felt the knuckles. She dropped her shirt.
Whoever did that had some max power.
No need to tell me that.
But 2 inches over, and you could have died.
Pine looked at her curiously. Mercy said,
Your diaphragm and the aorta behind it. A blow that hard, especially if you weren't really ready for it, could have caused you to stop breathing. And if it had damaged your aorta and it ruptured later, like being in a car accident, and you hit the steering wheel because your seatbelt doesn't work or the airbag doesn't come out, you'd bleed out in no time. But where they hit you, that doesn't happen.
I guess they wanted to keep me alive to answer their questions. And how do you know so much about that anyway?
I told you, I do some MMA. Strictly local junior league stuff because I'm nearly 40 pounds over the UFC's heaviest weight class. I studied up on that stuff. A good ab wall makes all the difference. So how do you think they're going to contact you about Carol?
Maybe a note left at the hotel?
But they can't expect me to just do whatever they want me to, with no guarantee that Carol is even alive or that they'll let her go.
You said there are other agents here. You gonna tell them if you get a note? Pine said nothing for a moment.
I'm sure if I do, her abductors will kill Carol.
Then I guess it's just you and me. Sort of like real, real old times, sis. Chapter 64. An agonizing 4 days had passed with no word from Blum or her captors. The Porsche had been recovered on a dirt road 20 miles out of town. The forensic team had gone over it without finding the prints or trace of anyone other than Pine, Blum, and Mercy, who'd had her prints taken for elimination purposes. The APB had produced not one sighting. Because Blum was a Bureau employee, additional resources had been deployed. They had nothing to show for it. Pine was now sitting across from McAllister and Bertrand in the hotel dining room, which had become their ad hoc operations room. McAllister's face and eyes showed the lack of sleep. Bertrand looked livelier, but Pine didn't need lively. She needed results. McAllister cast a look at Pine that made her stiffen. Yeah? She said expectantly.
I'm going to venture into speculation. Speculation that might cause you some concern.
Fire away.
Could it be possible that your sister had something to do with Blum's disappearance? By her own admission, she was the last person with Blum before she disappeared, and her prints were in the car.
Because she was in the car. And what would be her motive?
Who knows? You don't really know the woman, Pine. Admit that.
I know her well enough. She was helping Carol try to find me. She couldn't be working with the people who snatched me.
How do you know that?
I told you. The man who is questioning me wants my sister because he says she killed his brother. They're not working together. He wants to kill her. They followed him to a house. They were probably spotted. They took Carol. McAllister shot his partner a wary glance.
Okay, so why not snatch them both if the guy really wants your sister? Why leave her and take Carol? Your sister said she was in the house where they were. Yet they just take off and leave the golden goose behind. It makes no sense.
McAllister, they might not have known she was even in the house. They may not have even known that Carol and Mercy had hooked up. It was a spontaneous thing. They probably spotted Carol in the Porsche. And if they'd been following us before, they would have seen me and Carol together.
So when they took you, they thought you were your sister?
That's right. With the hair and our height, she and I closely resemble each other enough for a mistaken identity to happen, particularly to a couple of strangers like the guys who grabbed me. But then they found my shield and realized their mistake. McAllister leaned back and rubbed a hand across his chin.
So why no word from the captors about Carol? They must want to make an exchange, don't you think?
I would say yes. And I don't know why we haven't heard from them. McAllister tilted his head to eye Bertrand before turning back to Pine.
And when and if that contact comes, we'll be in the loop, right?
I know Bureau protocols on abduction cases, Agent McAllister, Pine said, more sharply than she probably intended.
Knowing and acting on those protocols are two separate things,
was his lobbed response.
And I don't want to be sitting here drinking my 100th cup of coffee only to find out you're playing the hand all on your own.
What I'm going to be doing is the best I can to make sure Carol comes back safe and sound.
No argument there, but you didn't answer my question.
You know how these things go down, replied Pine.
Let's face facts. The odds of Blum coming back in anything other than a body bag are pretty damn low. Do you disagree?
Yeah, I do disagree, because I'm on the case.
Bravado is not going to help, but moving on to another subject. Tim Pine?
I already told you. I have no idea where he is.
Have you heard from him or your mother?
No.
Not in any way,
he said, watching her closely. Pine, sensing a trap, said, meaning what exactly? In a dream? Telepathy? On a Ouija board? McAllister cleared his throat, finished his coffee, and said,
Agents have talked to Jack Lineberry. He mentioned a letter that your mother had written to him, and that he had given it to you.
Pine sucked in a breath. Right. Sorry, I didn't think of that.
Can I see the letter?
There are no clues in it, and it's pretty personal.
The whole thing is personal, Pine. And it's the only communication that we know of from your mother after she left you. We believe that she and Tim Pine hooked up after fabricating his death.
Vincenzo went there to kill Tim. He defended himself and Vincenzo died. They covered it up because they saw this as a chance to finally get away from the mob. I already told you all that.
That may well be the case, but right now all I know for a fact is that the man in the grave was Ito Vincenzo when your mother and Jack Lineberry lied and said it was Tim Pine. Their motivations notwithstanding, that is a crime. And as I'm sure you know, I can't take your word for it that Tim Pine killed Vincenzo in self-defense.
He kidnapped my sister and almost killed me, barked Pine. You don't think he would have tried to murder the man he thought was our father?
If the killing was justified, he has nothing to worry about. But we're not there yet, as you also well know. If somebody could get off killing another person based on what-ifs and maybes, we'd have a lot more murders and far emptier prisons.
He reached over and tapped her hand.
If you were working this case on the Bureau's end, would you do anything differently than what I'm doing? If so, I'm listening.
Pine shut her eyes, but just for a moment, her mind whirling at warp speed, processing all of this. When she opened them, she said, I'll get the letter for you.
Thank you,
said McAllister, an edge of relief in his voice. Pine rose and looked down at him. If you hear anything on Carol's whereabouts, let me know, and I'll do likewise.
Thank you for finally answering my question.
After Pine stalked off, McAllister turned to his colleague.
You stick to her like superglue, Neil.
The younger agent nodded, rose, and headed off. Chapter 65. Another 24 hours went by with no word about Blum and no demand from her captors. Mercy and Pine were sharing the latter's room at the hotel. Over lunch in their room, Pine said, Something is off. It doesn't take this long to communicate. Maybe they're trying to put the squeeze on you. Get you uptight, hoping you make a mistake. Pine put down her coffee cup. Her sister was wearing a pair of her jeans that were 2 inches too short, and a shirt that was a little tight across her broad shoulders, but rode well over the rest of her torso. I guess that could be. But they're also allowing us time to come up with a plan of our own. And are we coming up with a plan of our own? Asked Mercy, as she put the last forkful of salad into her mouth. Pine watched with a twinge of heartbreak as her sister sopped up every last bit of salad dressing with her piece of roll before depositing it in her mouth as well. The plate looked clean enough to be used again. Mercy caught her looking and said, I don't waste food. Yeah, I get that. In answer to your question, it's hard to come up with a plan when you don't know what the other side is going to do. But McAllister has notified the FBI about the situation, and they are standing ready, as are the local cops. And the APB is still out there. So you think this is going to go down in Asheville? Pine looked at her thoughtfully. Not necessarily. What are you thinking? I'm thinking that your using your credit card brought the people who took Carol to Asheville. Meaning they put a trace on my card? Yes, but they knew other things, and I'm wondering where they learned. Shit! What? Pine held up a hand and made a call. She put the phone on speaker and laid it on the table between them. Wanda Atkins sounded upset. Agent Pine, you never called me back. I know, I'm sorry, things got a little crazy. But I remember you saying you had something else to tell me? That some other people had visited you? That's right. But first things first, did you find Mercy? Yes, I did. And your call was very helpful. Thank you. Well, that's good. I'm glad. But that gal scared the bejesus out of me. Are you sure she's right in the head? Pine glanced at Mercy with a nervous smile. Tell me about these other people. That was the other reason I called you. 2 people came by asking questions about Mercy and you. When was this? The same day Mercy came by, only later. They just showed up on my doorstep. What did they want? They said Mercy had murdered somebody. They were trying to find her and convince her to turn herself in. Who were they? I don't know. They didn't give me their names. But I think they were with the police or something. They seemed very professional, and I told them that you had been by to see me. I gave them your card. Who was she supposed to have murdered? Did they give you a name?
No, they didn't say.
Was the man tall and lean, dark hair, dressed nicely, good looking?
Yes, that's right.
And the other person?
A woman, about your height, but leaner. Dark hair, very pretty, very intense.
She what?
Well, she seemed to be blaming me for what happened to Mercy, like laying a guilt trip on me. I didn't care for that.
Okay. The woman evidently wanted a sympathetic response from Pine, but she wasn't going to get it. Go on.
And when I showed them your card, the fellow asked the woman if she recognized the name, but she said she didn't. She said something like, "There are thousands of female FBI agents." I asked her if she was an agent, and she said no, but that she knew some.
So let me get this right. They didn't give you their names. I'm assuming they didn't have badges or credentials showing they actually were police. So why did you talk to them?
Well, they seemed nice and professional, like I said.
Wanda, I need to know everything, and I mean everything.
Okay, okay, the woman said in a flustered tone. The man paid me $2,000 in cash. I really didn't have a choice. I had to take it. Me and Lynn barely get by with all the medical bills, and let me tell you, Medicare and the VA don't cover it all, not by a long shot.
Did you see the car they drove up in?
No. When I answered the door, the lady pointed out that somebody had knocked down our lamppost. I guess that distracted me. I bet it was Mercy. Like I said, she scared the bejesus out of me. Said she wanted to kill me and Lynn.
I did knock it down, said Mercy. I did that to the lamppost so I wouldn't do it to you.
Wanda snapped. Is that you, Mercy? I didn't know you were on the call.
Well, I am.
What you did was not very nice. It'll cost something to fix that lamppost.
You came into $2,000 because of me, so there's that. Pine interjected impatiently. Wanda, would you be able to recognize these people?
Yes, I think so. They both kind of, you know, stood out, so to speak.
Pine checked her watch. I'd like to come and see you today.
Why?
You can give us fuller details. And I want to check around the neighborhood. Somebody may have seen the people too. And the car. And maybe gotten its license plate number. We need to find these people, and this is the only lead we have right now.
Why do you need to find them?
Because I'm pretty sure they're the ones who kidnapped Carol Blum, the woman who was with me when we visited you.
Oh my God. I feel like I've been dropped into some damn spy movie or something.
Only this is real life. So you'll be home this evening?
Yes. I really don't go nowhere anymore.
By the way, we found Desiree. She's in prison.
What? What for?
Keeping another little girl prisoner.
Christ almighty. Hope she never gets out.
I've got some things to finish up, and then we'll head out. We can probably be there around 7 this evening.
Are these really bad people? They seemed very nice.
I'll see you around 7. Chapter 66. Pine was driving the Porsche SUV the police had recovered, and her sister was riding shotgun. In the back seat was Special Agent Neil Bertrand. He was there because Drew McAllister had insisted Pine allow him to accompany them. She had introduced Bertrand to her sister. The tall, lanky agent seemed intrigued by Mercy Pine. He had no doubt learned some of her history, but he had asked no questions and rendered no judgments, for which Pine was appreciative. The day was turning stormy with the clouds moving in and hovering dome-like over them as they passed through Chattanooga, Tennessee, on the wide asphalt strip of I-75. The wind started to buffet the SUV, and Pine gripped the wheel with both hands. The traffic was heavy. Tractor-trailer rigs blew past her on both sides, carrying the commerce of the country to where it needed to go.
You really think Wanda Atkins will be able to help you find Blum?
Asked Bertrand. I'm convinced the people who are there are the same ones who have Carol. And it's not like we have an abundance of leads.
She glanced at him in the mirror. Do you have a better idea?
No,
he admitted. How long have you been assigned to the WFO?
2 years. Before that, I was an RA in Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Very different from an agent's life in D.C., noted Pine.
Yes, it is.
Which do you prefer? Asked Pine.
I liked Arkansas. Got to know the people. The work wasn't as challenging as I would have hoped, though they do have drug rings and bank robberies and white supremacist groups in that area.
Just like pretty much everywhere else, said Pine.
The WFO has a lot more bureaucracy, but it's an important stepping stone in an agent's career. I know you were assigned there at some point.
I was. Then I got out. I like to work on my own. Shattered Rock, Arizona is my stomping ground, and I couldn't be happier, and I can't wait to get back. The import of her words struck Pine, and she glanced at Mercy, who was staring out the window and didn't appear to be listening.
McAllister said you could have moved up at the Bureau if you wanted to, gotten a supervisory job at one of the field offices.
Yeah, move right up to a desk overseeing other agents' work instead of doing that work. No thanks, not why I signed up.
I get that. It is a trade-off.
And every agent has to make up their mind about what they want. She looked at him again. And I can see you're not there yet. He smiled.
Nope, not yet.
Well, you'll get there. Don't worry. It was dark when they got to Huntsville, and the storm they had been riding into most of the way was about to unleash its fury on the town. Clouds swirled into black and gray masses with threads of crackling lightning embellishing their underbellies, like pulsating veins in the brain.
Gonna be a doozy,
said Bertrand, staring out the window.
Glad we didn't fly here.
I've never been on a plane, said Mercy suddenly. What's it like? Bertrand glanced uncertainly at Pine before answering.
Usually smooth and very fast, of course. Just don't eat the food, at least in coach class. Not that they give you any food these days. Starvation seems to be the goal at 35,000 feet. And they pack you in like sardines. And with your height, the seats will be a little snug. I'm 6'3", so I always try to book the aisle or a bulkhead. That way I can at least stretch my legs out halfway. Or deep vein thrombosis, here I come.
Sounds great. Can't wait to try it, cracked Mercy. Bertrand smiled as they pulled into the Atkinses' driveway. As they walked past the toppled lamppost, Pine caught Mercy smiling maliciously at her handiwork and couldn't help but smile as well. A few drops of rain fell and they hurried onto the porch. Pine knocked and then knocked again when no one answered.
Place is dark,
said Bertrand, glancing at his watch.
It's 7 on the dot. They should be expecting us, right?
Yes, they should, said Pine, pulling her Glock. Bertrand and Mercy did the same with their weapons. Pine looked through one of the door's side lights and saw nothing helpful in return. The rain started to fall harder, and streaks of lightning ranged across the sky with claps of thunder dutifully following. Pine pounded on the door.
Wanda, open up! Are you okay?
She tried the door, but it was locked. Pine glanced at Bertrand. His gaze was darting in all directions, and he looked ready for whatever came their way. She looked at Mercy, who seemed puzzled but calm. Pine took a step back, planted her back foot firmly on the wooden decking of the porch, and lashed out with a kick aimed right at the door's hardware. It buckled, but didn't break. Mercy put her shoulder to it, and that did the trick. The portal popped open and swung back hard on its hinges, banging into the wall.
Mrs. Atkins? Wanda! Called out Pine.
She stepped through the opening and the other two followed. Bertrand was the last one through. He groped with his hand for a light switch. Wait, cautioned Pine. In the glare of illumination from the storm, she surveyed the front room. There was no wheelchair and no Len. There was nobody. No lights were on. It was like the house had been abandoned.
They could have had an emergency, said Pine. Maybe with Len. He'd had a stroke.
Do they have a car?
Asked Bertrand.
I suppose so. Wanda said she didn't really go anywhere anymore. But there is a garage. The vehicle might be in there.
But if there was an emergency, Surely they would have called an ambulance,
noted Bertrand.
They might be at the hospital.
Maybe. She pointed Bertrand toward the kitchen.
We'll take the bedrooms and bathrooms, she whispered. You take the kitchen and then the garage.
Bertrand nodded and headed off. Chapter 67. The powder room off the foyer was empty. But when Pine and Mercy reached the doorway of the main floor bedroom, Pine hissed,
"Shit!"
Wanda Atkins was lying motionless on the bed. Len was in his wheelchair, but hanging off to the side in a way that suggested a total lack of consciousness.
"What's wrong with them?" muttered Mercy.
Pine edged forward and touched Len's wrist with her index finger, holding it there, feeling for a pulse. She next checked his neck pulse, then ran a hand over his face. Cold. She raised one of his arms. It was supple. He was dead, but clearly not long enough for rigor mortis to set in. That made sense, because she had talked to Wanda only about 6 hours ago. She took out her light and ran it over him. She saw no obvious wounds or other marks, and nothing that could tell her how the man had died. She looked over at Wanda to see Mercy standing next to the bed. Pine joined her.
She looks like she's sleeping, said Mercy.
Pine dispelled that notion when she hit Wanda's eyes with her light and got nothing in return, except the unrelenting stare of the deceased. Still, she checked for a pulse and found none. The woman was cold. She ran her light over her looking for ligature marks, a wound, frothing on the lips to indicate poison.
She's dead? Asked Mercy.
Pine nodded and then flinched as she sniffed the air.
Do you smell smoke?
Both sisters turned to the doorway.
Bertrand!
Pine cried out. When he didn't answer, Pine gripped her sister's hand as she gazed at the large oxygen tank in the corner and remembered the others in the front room.
Bertrand!
She edged out of the room with Mercy right behind.
Bertrand!
They hustled forward and entered the kitchen. Pine hit the room with her light and stopped when it held on Bertrand, sitting slumped in a chair. She raced to him and almost fell. She shone her light on the floor and with a sickening feeling, saw the fresh pools of blood there. She eased over to the agent, then took a step back when she saw the 4-inch incision someone had made across his neck. She looked at his white shirt now turned red. The blood flow had reached all the way to his belt. She pointed her gun around the space. Pine knew they had ambushed him as soon as he came into the kitchen, slit his throat so he couldn't cry out, and dumped him to die seconds later in this chair. His eye stared wide and unseeing at the pebbled ceiling. His jaw was slack, and his skin was already turning pale from no blood running through the veins. She looked at the back door. It was open. The killer's exit? The storm was raging out there now, and copious amounts of wind were being driven through the opening. If they could catch the bastard who had done this. She looked back at Bertrand. She had lost an agent. The first time ever. Her fault.
Lee!
Pine jerked her head at Mercy, who was pointing at the cabinets. After finding Bertrand, Pine had forgotten about the smell of smoke. Now that dilemma was presenting itself front and center. The cabinets were flaming up, the fire racing across the lacquered wood like someone had dumped gas on paper and struck a match. Pine had never seen a conflagration build that quickly. She whirled around, forgetting about the fire just for a moment and with good reason. It had been replaced by something even deadlier to them. For in her mind, Pine once more saw all the large oxygen tanks strewn around the house. This was no longer a residence in the suburbs. This was a bomb, just about to detonate. She grabbed her sister's arm and pulled her along.
This whole place is going to blow!
They reached the front porch and ran the short distance through the driving rain to the Porsche. Any second, Pine expected to be hurled off her feet from the blast wave of a house disappearing and taking her and her sister along with it. We'll just be ash, cremated together. She flung open the driver's side door and Mercy did the same on the other side. An instant later, everything turned black for both of them. Chapter 68. Pine opened her eyes for a moment, and then closed them. She did so again, fighting against the feeling of cement lodged between her eyelids and her face. It was like being in a nightmare and struggling to open your eyes to see the terrible things coming for you. Finally, they stayed open and she was staring at a low ceiling of whitewashed brick. A brick ceiling was quite unusual. She slowly sat up and stared over at her sister. Mercy was sitting upright on a bunk, her back against the wall. Pine looked around and took in the barred and chicken-wired window and barred door. Where are we? Mercy shrugged. We look to be in a jail. Pine stood on wobbly legs, put a hand against the wall to steady herself, then stretched out her back. Okay. I feel like I was hit by a tank. Same here, but I don't remember what happened after I opened the car door. Pine nodded and glanced out the window at the foreboding terrain outside. She also saw the high fence topped by concertina wire. What the hell is this place? Saw a guy with an AK walking by out there earlier. Pine checked her pocket for her phone. It was gone, along with both her pistols. Yeah, they took my gun too, said Mercy. Pine sat down on her bunk, rubbed her eyes, and said in a bleak voice, they killed Neil Bertrand, and the Atkinses are dead too, and we're here. Yep, said Mercy. I think we got played. They were obviously waiting for us there. But how could they know we were going to visit Wanda? Don't know. I wonder if the house burned up or blew up first, said Mercy. Whoever took us was waiting for us in the Porsche. When I opened the door, I thought I saw something, but then everything went black. They might have hit us with some gas or something. Mercy nodded, but said nothing. They both perked up when they heard footsteps. It was a man dressed in jeans and a flannel shirt. He was carrying two trays. He put one down and waited. Then another man appeared, dressed similarly. He was carrying a riot shotgun, Pine noted, like they used in prisons. It was designed to kill over a wide, shallow field of bodies. The first man unlocked the door and slid the two trays through. Pine looked at each man. They did not look back at her. She said, can you at least tell us where we are? The first man locked the door, and they both left without speaking or even looking at them. It was like they had left food for two invisible people. Pine picked up one tray and handed it to Mercy while she took the other. They sat on their bunks and ate the food and drank the glasses of water provided. When they were finished, the same two men came back and retrieved the trays. This exact timing made Pine believe they were under surveillance. 5 minutes later, another man appeared. Peter Buckley had on jeans, a white-collared shirt, a tan vest, a brown corduroy jacket with olive-green elbow patches, and a pair of all-weather boots. He pulled up a chair and sat down, facing them from the other side of the bars. He looked first at Pine, and then settled his gaze on Mercy. You're the guy I saw at the house, with the lawyer, said Mercy. Buckley said nothing. He just kept staring at them. Pine let this scrutiny go on for a bit before saying, well, we're here. Buckley looked at her. He didn't smile. He didn't chuckle. He didn't look grim or angry or triumphant. He simply appeared curious.
Yes, you are.
When he spoke, Pine's suspicions were confirmed. He was the man who had spoken to her when she'd been kidnapped. You killed an FBI agent and two other people, said Pine.
No, the Atkinses had a heart attack or a stroke when my men broke into the house. They never touched them.
And Agent Bertrand?
He was supposed to have been anesthetized, as you two were. Unfortunately, things went awry. They're not sure how the fire started, but there's not much left of the house. The important thing is that you are both here.
How did you know we'd be at the Atkinses? Asked Pine.
We hid a tracking device in the Porsche after my colleague took Ms. Blum, and we had the Atkinses' line tapped. We heard your conversation.
Pine closed her eyes for a moment, inwardly seething at this oversight on her part. And do you also have Carol Blum? She asked after she reopened her eyes. Buckley nodded.
She is an important part of this.
And what exactly is this? Buckley turned back to Mercy.
You killed my brother.
No, I didn't.
What I meant to say was you didn't know you had, but you did.
That's as clear as mud.
His name was Ken. You stopped him from hurting Rosa. He pulled a knife and then a gun on you. You beat him up.
Mercy sucked in a breath and looked over at Pine. He wasn't dead. I checked his pulse. And even though he hit his head, he wasn't a quad. I checked that too. Buckley said.
He later died of a brain aneurysm, probably from his head hitting the ground.
Mercy eyed him more closely. I saw you at that house and thought you looked familiar. It's because you look like Ken around the eyes and jaw. You said he deserved it, Pine pointed out. It was kill or be killed, and she didn't even know he was dead. So what exactly are you trying to do here? Buckley crossed one leg over another.
It's payback, but it's complicated payback. Not really connected to the incident with Ken and your sister.
Now Pine sucked in a breath. Buckley smiled at her discomfort.
Yes, we know all about that. What you two represent is symbolic, really.
Again, clear as mud, as my sister said before.
The government caused my father's death and turned my mother and my sisters against the rest of the family. I was the only one to really make anything of myself. The payback is against the government. Since I, of course, can't do it directly, I'm going to do it indirectly, using you two.
So, you're going to kill us as revenge on the government? Doesn't that strike you as a little bit insane?
Not at all. It's incredibly logical and has a certain symmetry. And Ken was my brother. Regardless of whether it was justified or not, your sister killed him. In my world, that requires payback. So I'm killing two birds with one stone, at least figuratively.
So we both die then?
Not necessarily.
What does that mean? And where is Carol?
She's safe. In answer to your first question, it will become apparent in short order.
What will?
What I have devised for you. But let me warn you, it will be more difficult than anything you've ever faced.
We've both faced a lot, said Pine, while Mercy just watched him.
You've faced nothing like this,
said Buckley.
I can assure you.
On that, he rose and left. Chapter 69. 2 days passed, and Pine slept uncomfortably, waking at odd hours. She noted with some envy that her sister slept soundly, seemingly untroubled by the situation they were in. During the day, and knowing that they were probably under surveillance, they discussed things. Mercy filled Pine in on what had happened with Ken. I didn't think I hit him that hard, she said. But he was going to shoot me. You did nothing wrong, said Pine.
Oh, I know that, said Mercy matter-of-factly.
They talked about Mercy's life after she was taken. Her years with the Atkinses were painful for Pine to learn about, and she believed that Mercy glossed over some of it, perhaps to spare her the hardship of learning about it. The years after her sister escaped from the Atkinses were also difficult to hear about, particularly when she had been repeatedly brutalized by people along the way. I'll let it happen, Mercy said simply. And then I stopped letting it happen. You didn't let anything happen. The Atkinses kept you in a cage, and then you got free. You weren't capable of handling any of what happened to you, Mercy. None of this was fair to you. Nothing about life is fair, at least for people like me. But I got things straightened out eventually. Pine watched her twin closely. Now I wish you had left me. Then you wouldn't be stuck here. I was the one the dude was after. They would have found me at some point. At least we can face it together. Have each other's backs. Pine reached out and touched her sister's arm. I just wish I knew where they were keeping Carol. Just because he said she was okay means nothing. I want to see that she's okay. I wonder what the guy meant about what we would be facing. He strikes me as the type to understate rather than embellish things. So I guess we're right to be worried. Do you think the FBI is looking for us? I'm sure they are. They'll have gone over the Atkinses' house by now. What's left of it anyway? They'll have found Bertrand's remains. They'll bring everything they have on this one, she said this louder, in the hopes that they were being spied on. Mercy glanced out the window. Any idea where we are? Pine looked out the window, too. Western U.S., I think. If I had to guess, I'd say Utah or Idaho, maybe Colorado. I've been through those states a lot, and I recognize the topography. Then we must have been flown here. I don't think we were out long enough to have been driven. Which means the man has his own jet with pilots who won't talk. He looked like money, said Mercy. And this looks like some sort of compound. A jail, perimeter fencing, armed guards. Mercy said in barely a whisper. Like the dude from Waco? I read about that. Pine replied in a low voice. David Koresh? I don't know. Our guy strikes me as more of a businessman, not some crazed cult leader. I guess we'll find out. Mercy lay back on her bed and put her arm behind her head. Pine watched her for about a minute. Certain things inside of her building, like a jet's engines creating barely suppressed thrust before takeoff. Finally, unable to stay silent any longer, she said, I'm sorry about everything, Mercy. Mercy glanced at her. This wasn't your fault. Dude was after me. I should be apologizing to you. No, I didn't mean that. I meant... Pine looked down, gathering the words she wanted to use as precisely as possible. Only her emotion was impeding her effort at logic. Finally, emotion won out. I should have looked for you long before now. I just went on with my life, and it was like you weren't. I didn't deserve to have any fucking thing. I hate myself. Pine leaned forward, her head nearly touching her knees, wrapped her arms around herself and started to sob. It was like someone had just dropped an entire world on her soul, crushing it to nothing. Mercy sat up, looking alarmed, and then her features changed to understanding. She shifted over to the other bunk, drew close to Pine, and finally wrapped her long, strong arms around her. She pressed her mouth to Pine's ear, as Pine was racked over and over again with sobs, her body shaking uncontrollably. Mercy tightened her grip, trying to quell the guilt-ridden rage inside of her twin. She said in a low voice, You're going to get through this. We are going to get through this. You always figure it out. Always. Pine shook her head fiercely. No, I don't. It took me 30 damn years to find you. I'm useless. Look at me. Look at me. Lee, look at me. A teary Pine finally gazed at her sister. Do you remember that old oak tree in our yard? You would climb to the very top, and it would make Mom so mad because she was afraid you were going to fall and kill yourself. Pine nodded. I remember. But you always figured out how to get back down. Every single time. I watched you do it. You know that, right? Pine nodded dumbly. Well, this time we're both up that tree, but you're going to get us back down.
How can you be so sure of that?
Said Pine with a pleading look on her face, and sobs still coming jerkily from her. I believe in you, Lee. Always did. And that got me through more than you'll ever know. Slowly, painfully so, Pine's sobs subsided. Her body stopped shaking, her breathing slowed. And all the time, Mercy's grip on her held firm. I'm here, Lee. I'm here. Pine let out one additional long gasp of air, straightened, turned to her sister, and wrapped her arms around her, and held her just as tightly as Mercy was embracing her.
I'll never let you go, Mercy. Whatever happens, I'll never let you go. It's both or none from now on.
Mercy patted her sister's back and stared up at the ceiling with a troubled look. Nothing in her life had ever gone as planned, and her features betrayed what she was feeling. She had found her sister, or her sister had found her. They were together after all these years, and now they would probably die together. In another room of the jail, Britt Spector sat alone in front of a video screen set up on a desk,
with a pair of audio buds in her ears. She had just finished watching and listening to this entire exchange between the two sisters. She cut the video feed off and yanked the buds out of her ears, and with her own memories racking her, Spectre stared at the screen as the tears rolled down her cheeks. Chapter 70. Pine and Mercy were jolted from sleep by the drumming of boots on wood. They sat up on their bunks as the half-dozen large men filed into the room. Four of them were armed with shotguns. The other two held restraints designed to transport prisoners. Buckley was not with this group. Pine searched the men's faces. They were all hard, featureless, soulless. They were here to do a job, a well-paid job, no doubt, and they were going to do it. Morals, issues of right and wrong were never going to be entertained by such people.
On your feet,
said one man. He was the smallest among them at 6'1", but he also looked the sharpest. Where are we going? Asked Pine. And where's Carol?
We're taking you to her. Now on your feet.
The door was opened and both women's ankles and wrists were manacled with the chains, which were then interconnected around their waists, forcing them to do the prison shuffle as they left their cell. One man nudged Pine in the back with his shotgun.
Now you know how it feels to perp walk, FBI.
They were led outside where it was cold and dark, with a raw wind blowing in from the west. Pine shivered and felt sprinkles of rain land on her head. As they were marched across the dirt, she could see other buildings, the guard tower, and a row of vehicles. This clearly was a compound of some kind, stuck in the middle of nowhere. Could the well-dressed and well-spoken man who was doing all this really be some sort of cult leader like a David Koresh? Or was he the head of some criminal organization? The men surrounding them looked far more like hardened criminals than potential Kool-Aid drinkers. If so, that did not bode well for Pine, Mercy, and Blum. They were led into a large building that looked like a barn, and there they were separated. Before that happened, Pine had a glimpse of something large in the middle of the space. She couldn't see what it was, because it was draped with a huge tarp. She was led into a small room by two of the armed men. Hanging on wall pegs were articles of clothing. One man took off her chains while the other kept a shotgun pointed at Pine. The man stepped back, coiling the chains around his arm. He said,
"Take your clothes off in that little stall over there and put those on."
He indicated the things hanging on the pegs. Why? The other man waggled the shotgun.
Just put them on. We'll be waiting right here. You got 2 minutes before we come in there, so hustle it up. And no shoes or socks. Leave those behind.
Pine grabbed the items and marched into the stall. She stripped down to her underwear and then looked at the articles of clothing. What the hell? She slipped on the Lycra shorts, a chest protector, and the sports top. She stepped out of the stall and looked at the men. What is going on? They just motioned her to the doorway they had come through. They returned to the main area where Pine saw Mercy come out of another area of the building, wearing clothes nearly identical to her own. Her twin stared back at her, obviously as confused as she was. They were led over to the tarp, and that was when Buckley appeared. He was dressed in khaki pants, a tan sports coat with a yellow crewneck sweater underneath, and sturdy brown boots. Pine glared at him. What in the hell is all this about? In answer, Buckley motioned to a man standing in a far corner, his hand on a metal lever connected to a machine with a flywheel and a chain. The man pulled on the lever, and the space was filled with the whine of engaged hydraulics. They all watched as the tarp, attached to a chain at its pinnacle, was slowly lifted. Revealed underneath was something very familiar to Mercy. A UFC cage. She glanced over at her sister, her mouth agape. The tarp was swung away from over the cage and deposited on the ground. Pine looked at Buckley. That doesn't answer my question.
This will,
said Buckley. He motioned to another man. He disappeared from sight, but came back about 10 seconds later, leading a blindfolded and gagged Carol Blum.
Carol!
Exclaimed Pine. She tried to reach her, but a wall of armed men barred her way.
Blum was forced to sit in a chair next to the cage, and her blindfold was taken off, but her gag remained. As her eyes adjusted to the light, she saw Pine, and then Mercy, and her eyes widened to the extreme edge of their range. Pine whirled on Buckley.
Look, just let her go. Your beef is with us, not her. Just let her go.
Buckley stayed silent for a moment, and then said,
Are you finished? Because I have a schedule to keep.
Pine just scowled back.
Good. Now, as you can see, you are about to engage in battle with your sister.
The hell I am!
He looked at the man next to Blum and nodded. The man took out a serrated-edged knife and held it against Blum's neck.
If you don't fight, your friend dies, and then you both die, too. It's up to you.
Mercy stepped forward.
I killed your brother, not them. Let me fight one of your guys. Hell, I'll fight all of them. But you don't have to hurt my sister or Carol.
Again, Buckley remained silent for a moment.
Are you finished?
Mercy glanced at Pine but said nothing.
Let me introduce you to your referee.
From out of the shadows stepped Britt Spector. She was dressed in a striped hoodie with a kangaroo pouch and black pants that hung loosely on her, with a knapsack over one shoulder. Her hair was tied back. She came to stand next to Buckley. Spector didn't look at Pine or Mercy. Her gaze just stared out. Buckley said,
Now for the rules. There will be 4 rounds, 5 minutes each round. If, at any time, I feel that you are not fighting your hardest.
He turned to the man next to Blum.
Jason over there will make an incision on your friend's skin. Each subsequent incision will be deeper and draw more blood. The ending of this is easy to see. The more times I request the cuts, the more blood she loses. A tipping point will be reached, and that will be that. But I will be fair in my calls.
Sure you will, snapped Mercy. And how exactly does this end? Said Pine.
If one of you wins by knockout, you live, as does Ms. Blum. And the other one dies. If neither of you clearly wins, you both die, along with Miss Blum.
And you expect us to believe that you'll just let us walk out of here to tell the cops what happened?
I didn't say the winner walks out of here. I said you get to live. I didn't say where or how.
An enraged Pine bolted toward Buckley, but two of the men tackled her before she could get to him. She fell at his feet. He looked down at her and then nodded at the man next to Blum. Pine saw this and screamed.
No, please, don't hurt her.
The man ripped open Blum's sleeve with the knife and cut delicately into her skin. Blum jerked back as the blade sliced into her. She started to shake with pain. Pine was hauled to her feet and was vibrating with fury as Buckley looked at her in disappointment.
I expected better from you,
he said.
And your sister is apparently a real killer in the cage. You better bring your A-game.
He jerked his head at his men. They force-marched the two women into the ring. Spector followed, and then the door was closed behind them. Spector finally looked at them.
Are you two ready? What the fuck do you think? Snapped Pine.
If you don't fight hard, he will do exactly as he said he would to your friend. And you really expect us to believe he's not going to kill all three of us, regardless of what happens in here? Said Pine.
I don't know what else to tell you, said Spector, looking at the dirt.
Great. Thanks for the help, said Mercy.
I'm just doing my job.
Right. I'm sure he's paying you plenty.
Enjoy it, along with the memory of a triple homicide, barked Pine.
Spector led them over to the center of the ring. She pulled from the knapsack 2 pairs of UFC gloves and 2 mouthpieces. She helped the women get them on, and then looked over at a man who was standing next to a large countdown clock set on a table and visible to all in the cage.
Okay, I'm sure you both know the rules. Knockouts and armbar stops are in my sole judgment. Your level of fighting is up to him. And Carol is already bleeding some, so keep that in mind.
Both women looked over at Blum to see her pained face and the swelling patch of blood leaching onto her torn sleeve. Pine stared at her sister. Mercy looked back at her, with not a shred of hope on her features.
Well,
said Pine. Her voice was garbled because of the mouthpiece.
He was right about this being something I've never faced before.
Spectre said, Okay, step back, and then commence fighting on the sound of the horn. Pine looked once more at Mercy and shook her head. Shit, was all she could think to say. Chapter 71 When the horn sounded, they marched forward, and each assumed a defensive stance. Mercy looped a kick. Pine blocked it and then threw an awkward punch. The scream froze them. Blum's gag had been removed, and the man standing next to her had made a large cut on her upper arm, where blood was streaming down.
Carol!
Screamed Pine. Buckley called out.
I warned you. Now fight.
Spectre stepped between them and whispered. Do it, ladies, or she's dead. Just make contact and absorb the punishment. He's not an expert in MMA. Come on, you can do this. Pine gave her a curious look as she stepped back. Mercy eyed her sister and said, Let's give the asshole a show. Pine launched a right hook at Mercy's left oblique, and she fell back. As Pine charged forward, Mercy pivoted and landed a sidekick to Pine's jaw. Had her sister unleashed her full power, Pine's jaw would have been broken. It still hurt like hell. Pine clinched and then pushed her sister off. They landed solid blows with their fists and feet. They kept doing so until the horn sounded and the round ended. They retreated to separate sides, where a bottle of G2 with a squirt top was hanging from a hook on the fencing next to a white towel. Spectre held the bottle to Pine's mouth and let her suck on it. She wiped Pine's face, arms, and legs off with the towel. While she was doing that, Spectre said in a low voice, Just keep doing what you're doing. Pine eyed Spectre curiously. Just hang in there, said Spectre, and trust me. She went over to Mercy's side to provide hydration and toweling off and relayed the exact same thing. Buckley called through the fence.
Well done. Now keep it up. I want more.
The horn sounded, and the second round began. They met in the middle of the ring and started kicking and slugging. During a clinch, Pine mumbled, So do we trust her? Mercy said, Hell, do we have a choice? They heard another scream, and both turned to see the man slice into Blum's arm again. Then they both turned to Buckley, who was now standing at the chain-link fence.
Not a single knockdown yet?
Pine looked at Mercy, who tapped her chest. A silent communication occurred. It was like they were kids again playing in the backyard in Georgia. Pine stepped back and then exploded forward with a looping kick that slammed into the left side of Mercy's head. Mercy staggered backward, impacted by the fence, and went down to one knee, her top belly sucking in and out. Pine sprang forward, but Mercy had already risen and she drove a fist right into Pine's gut. She staggered back and dropped to her butt. Mercy was on her, and the two women struggled, each trying to armbar the other. Pine finally kicked free and rose with blood streaming down her face. It was with both pride and envy that Pine had to admit that though their strength levels were about equal, her sister was bigger, more limber, and a better MMA fighter than she was. The third round went just like the second did. Mercy and Pine pounded away. But Pine could tell Mercy was holding back on her blows, and Pine did her best to do the same and physically react as if she was getting the shit kicked out of her, which wasn't all that far from the truth. Both their faces were bloody, their limbs and torsos lumpy with bruises, their breathing ragged, and their bodies, despite the chilly air, dropping copious amounts of sweat. Standing by the fence, Buckley took all of this in and seemed to be enjoying himself. He even did a bit of shadow boxing to the amusement of his men, who were hooting and clapping and stamping their feet the whole time. Before the fourth and final round started, Spectre again administered hydration and toweling. As she did so, she relayed to each of them the same message. Listen for my signal at a minute to go. At the 30-second mark, fight like hell. I'll need the distraction. Then, she had stealthily pressed something rubbery into their ears while drying off their heads with the towel. Both women readied themselves for the final round. Spectre glanced subtly at the knapsack she had hung on the chain-link fence.